So why are we here? I mean, we all come from different countries all over the world to a very tiny place. What draws us here? I mean, in the vicinity where we live, we know there are places. There are temples, there are ashrams, there are meditation centers. I mean, something draws us here, just to this place. Not because it's just close, you know, just it's around, right around the corner or right around the block. Even in the first place, huh? What draw me here? I just read a book of Thanacha Mahabodha, the teacher, the venerable teacher of this monastery. And then I thought, I must see this man. I must see this man. I mean, if somebody knows something about this world, he must know. That's what draw me here. And I wanted to understand. Because I had just, you know, just similar questions to you. I always question. From the age I could think, you know, 15, I question, you know, what is this world about? What is this life about? What is this? What is that? Why is this like this? Why is that like that? They always interested me. And the only answers were found in our Christian background. But they never satisfied. I was brought up as a Christian, and the answers I got from Christianity never satisfied. So I had to look for something else. And the moment I found the teachings of the Lord Buddha, suddenly, you know, everything fell into place. Everything suddenly made sense. The reason why I'm here, the reason why I have this kind of characteristics, or why I'm this kind of individual, the reasons why this thing is happening to me, or that thing is happening to me, just make sense. Because it's the law of karma. It's what we don't want to do unto others, like we say in English or in German, what you don't want to do unto others, what you don't want others to do unto you, don't do unto others. Or don't do unto others what you don't want others to do unto you. I mean, that is karma. That's it. I mean, we know it, but do we act accordingly to it? I mean, if we hit a person because we don't like him, I mean, do we reflect about it before we hit it that this will come back to us? If you say a bad word about the person, do we reflect before about it that it will come back to us? If we steal something, or if we take something from somebody, do we reflect about it that it will come back to us? No. We just don't do it. So we have this idiom, so we have this saying in our own language. We still do not act accordingly. Because something drives us, you know, just to hit this person, or something drives us just to say something bad about that person because we don't like it, or something is driving us to take things that, you know, we just want to for ourselves, and we just don't own, but somebody else is own. If every one of us in this whole world would apply this teaching or this saying to oneself, I mean, this world would be a paradise. I mean, there would be nothing wrong with it. It would be the absolute paradise. But how many people are acting according to it? Hardly. Hardly any. Why? Because within us rages anger or hate and greed. That makes us do things that we actually later on we regret. When we look back at our life, we regret quite a few things that we have done. And at the moment we've done, you know, we just were driven by something, a power or force, that we didn't even think about it, or we couldn't even identify, we just thought we needed to do this. And that is nothing than the power of avijja. The power of avijja that got us here in the first place, the power of avijja that makes us reborn, going from one life to the next. So what is this avijja? I mean, if you translate avijja, then it's actually the opposite of vijja. And vijja is knowingness. So avijja means not knowing. When you really get down to the meaning of avijja, then it is not knowing and not understanding. Because we do not know, and because we do not understand, we do the wrong things. That's all. We want to know. That is also one thing within us. We constantly want to know, we constantly want to understand, but we can only understand within conventional reality. And within conventional reality, the master of conventional reality is avijja. That does not understand and that does not know. So we are, what do you call it, catch 22. We cannot get out. As long as we try to understand with the tools that are in this conventional reality, we will not get out. Because we will never be able to understand, because the master of this conventional reality is nothing else than avijja. And we will never be able to know. Because the master himself does not know. But we tried, and we tried, and we tried. So what we use is that what is there, our brains to understand, our brains to rationalize. And then we try to understand. We try to understand by reading books or by studying this or by studying that. But do we really understand? I mean, in the end, we do have more or less to believe either what we see or what we think we understand. But do we really understand? No. As long as there is avijja, we will never be able to understand in line with the truth. That also tells us that there is something beyond. Something that is hidden by this conventional reality. And the moment we see this, what is hidden by this avijja, we will understand and we will know. So the first stage is actually to go into a state of calm, to put the mind in a state of calmness, in a state of stillness, in a state where everything disappears, what is not real. Or in other words, what is this conventional reality. When this disappears, the true, or the truth, will be unhidden. So how are we going to do this? It's very easy. I mean, it's easy told, yet it's so difficult to do. We just put our attention onto one point. Be it the point at the tip of the nose and observe the breath coming in and breath coming out. Not following the breath. Just observe it at the tip of the nose where the feeling of the breath coming in and breath coming out is strong. And whenever there is a memory or a thought that pulls us away from our point of concentration, we put it immediately back to the nose. That's it. We do it until there is no more thoughts, until there are no more memories coming up, then we go into the first realm of experience. It is also called upachara samadhi, or in other terms, access samadhi. I mean, this is the world that is beyond thinking. It is just the world of experience. It's a completely different realm that most of us people do not even know. It's when the mind stops, then we will experience. When the mind stops thinking, or when the mind stops churning out the thoughts and the memories, then we will realize there is something, there is another reality beyond that. And that is called upachara samadhi or access samadhi, the world of experience. We just experience. And when we just experience, amazingly enough, there is no fear, there are no worries, there is no loneliness. We are just centered, still, happy people. The moment our thoughts come back, immediately fear, anger, greed, and all these things come along. So, the best thing, the moment you are anywhere in trouble, just put your mind still. Then you are out of trouble. If you worry about this, just put your mind on the breath. Or just another way is just mentally repeat the word Buddha, 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 Buddha. Once you think Buddha, you can't think anything. So that is the easiest thing. Whenever there are troubles, whenever there are worries, whenever there is fear, we revert to the Buddha. Or we revert to the breath. And fear disappears, worries disappear, at least as long as we can stay on this point of concentration. It is neither the word Buddha, nor is it knowing the breath at the tip of the nose that leads us to stillness. It's the emptying the mind of thought that will lead to stillness. And happiness. Happiness is always there. We just don't see it. Because our mind is full of thoughts. Our mind is full of memories that bring most of the time unhappy feelings. And thoughts also, unhappy feelings. Or not comfortable feelings. Or not comfortable memories. We are constantly thinking about this. We never ask ourselves, why do I think about this? I know, you know, it's unpleasant. But we seem not to be able to stop it. That way is one way, or it's one method to stop it. Buddha, 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 Buddha. Or just put the attention on the concentration on the tip of the nose and observe the breath going in and out. Whenever there is a thought coming in, put the attention, grab it by the tail and put it back on the tip of the nose. That's it. That's all the magic we need. And then we come into that, once the thoughts are stopping, we come into this world of experience, or the world beyond thoughts, or the realm beyond thoughts, also called upachara samadhi, and there we feel safe. For the first time in our life, we feel safe. We're in a safe haven. It's always there. All what we need to do, you know, if we have a restroom in our, if we have a resting place in our house, and is locked by a door and we forgot where we put the key, I mean, all what we need to do is find the key, unlock the door, and go and have a rest. And the key to it is the word Buddha, mental repetition of the word Buddha, or the concentration on the tip of the nose. That is the key for unlocking the door, to find some happiness and peacefulness and stillness. Now, once we are in this in this upachara samadhi or in this access samadhi, I mean, we go on concentrating either on the word Buddha or on the breath. Whatever your method is, whatever you train with, or in the beginning if it's too difficult, you can use put with breathing in and do with breathing out. That's fine. Once we get more and more concentrated, one of the one of it will fall away. Either the Buddha will fall away or the press will fall away. And then we get more and more concentrated. When we are concentrating on the breath seems to get more subtle and more subtle, until it completely disappears from our awareness. It becomes so subtle that we cannot be aware of it anymore. And this is the moment to enter the deep state of samadhi. When we just revert, and what we see is what is happening when we concentrate on the breath, and the breath becomes more and more subtle, the concentration is still at the tip of the nose, but it seems just to fall into the place where the citta is. It just falls into the place where our heart is, or the citta is, the center of the breath, the center of the chest. So. And the same thing will happen with Buddha. The more we do Buddha, or the concentrated our Buddha is, the more seems to be our attention is more drawn into the heart area. And that's what these methods should lead. It should lead to the center of our chest, to our citta. That is just located there. And what brings us there? We have to know, or we understand the methods why they work. Because the nature, the true nature of our citta is nothing else than knowingness. So, using the methods to know about the breath coming in and the breath coming out, or the breath being subtle, or the breath being coarse, or the breath being long and the breath being short, leads us to the knowingness of our citta. And the same thing happens with the Buddha. Once the Buddha gets installed mentally, repeated by itself, then we observe the Buddha. And it will become stronger and slower each time. The more we get concentrated, the slower it is, until we have the feeling that we can't even, our mind is so concentrated. And it is a feeling that we just close it. We just close in on the point of concentration. That we can't think Buddha. And then it's the same thing. I mean, we just put our attention to the knowingness that knows that we cannot think Buddha, or that knows that the breath has disappeared. And then we fall into our citta. And once we fall in our citta, we will get one point. So one point is not two points. The observer of the breath and the breath will unify. Everything just becomes one point. That also means that we are not only aware of our breath, nor are we aware of any senses. I mean, the hearing senses disappear. The seeing, of course, disappears from the beginning because we close our eyes. And the feeling of the body disappears, every kind of impact, sense impact will disappear. And we have the feeling that the whole universe disappears. Nothing is left, and all what is left is this amazing knowingness. It's a clear, sharp knowingness. And the moment we enter this, I mean, there is no time. The moment we open our eyes, we just think we've just been there for a moment. But when we look at our watch, 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 hours can have passed by very easily. And we didn't move our body. Nothing. It just the same before we entered and after we gone off. It is one of the first wonders of meditation that every one of us who just puts his mind onto this work can experience. All what is needed is just, you know, the effort and determination not to let the mind go out in thinking, or not to let the heart go out into thinking and memories. That's all what is necessary. And then we can enter this deep state of samadhi. So it's not beyond our ability. But sometimes we have to struggle for this, to develop this ability. I mean, that's of course fair. We have to struggle all our life to develop this or develop that. We didn't mind. We didn't mind to learn to walk, did we? I mean, we struggled quite a bit, you know, and it was quite painful. We didn't mind to learn to talk. And it also was painful. Especially if our parents or if our brothers and sisters didn't understand our counterfeits. They didn't understand what we really wanted and they brought us the wrong thing, so we cried. So there's a lot of dukkha in that thing. So, we have to develop this ability. Once we develop, that's where we can go. And that's where we can really experience the things when everything disappears. And then we know that there is something left. And that is what is called the citta. Tanaja Mahapur calls the state of apana samadhi or deep state of samadhi as a preview of nibbana. That is what is left when everything has disappeared. That is what is left when avijja has completely disappeared. But of course, the moment we get out, you know, avijja is still coming back. It's still there. So, our task is then, once we gained the confidence, once we gained the energy that comes from this kind of rest, we know, every one of us knows. I mean, if we want to have some energy to do our work, I mean, we have to sleep and eat. So if we want to do our spiritual work, I mean, we have to rest the mind in stillness. Without being rested in stillness, it will not be able to work in a concise manner. It will just jump from here and jump to there. That is what is normal. So we have to put the mind to work. Doing what? I mean, where is avijja hidden? Avijja is hidden in these five khandhas. So we investigate the five khandhas and try to separate out avijja from the khandhas. Because at the moment avijja and the five khandhas seems to be in complete unison. Just like we, when we think about ourselves, we think in the terms of the five khandhas. I mean, sometimes we refer to our body. I mean, I'm tall, I'm heavyweight, or I'm old, or I'm young, or I'm full of energy. It's all I, our personality, refers then to the material realm of the body. Then, in other times, you know, we refer to us as our feelings. I feel happy, I feel sad, I'm depressed, I'm this or I'm that. Huh? That is the second group. Or sometimes we refer to our memories. Oh, I remember, you know, 15 years ago I did this or I did that or I was like that or I thought like that. That is referring to us as memory. But most of the time we refer to us as thoughts. I think like this, I have the opinion, I have this, or I think like that. Normally, that is the fourth group, the group of thought. And the last group that makes us is consciousness. But because consciousness is so fast, we can't even refer to it. We're just conscious, we are just aware of something is happening. I mean, we don't know what it would be like, you know, if there is no consciousness. Because if we are unconscious, we don't remember. So, without consciousness, nothing would come into our sense contact. So actually, consciousness is just knowing that something has come or arisen in our sense field. That's all. And these five groups, is that what we call I, or us, or mine? That's where all our difference lies, in the five groups. These five groups make women or men, make strong personalities or weak personalities, make gangsters or holy people. It all depends on the mixture of these five And is there anything, if there is anything that you can find that you call yourself is not within these five groups, please let me know. There's nothing. Everything, what we ever think about ourselves, is belonging to one of these groups. And that's why the Lord Buddha gave us this principle, or this help, or this method, to separate the things out, not to let them go, work hand in hand together. I mean, what makes a watch? Think about it. What makes a watch? I mean, the wheels inside. If the wheels wouldn't touch each other, it would make a watch. So one wheel, you know, is tricking the next wheel, and the next wheel is tricking another wheel. So they work hand in hand. And that's just the same thing for our groups, for our five groups. They work hand in hand, and they work so fast that we don't see it. The only conclusion we have, I want this or I don't like this. We don't see the groups working at a slow speed. They're working at high speed. And a sense input comes in, and immediately we say it's a chicken. But actually it has to go through memory to identify, first of all, that it was coming through the ear. And then secondly of all, what kind of noise was it? And then we find the best match for it, and then it tells us it was a chicken. I mean, if you come to a country where we don't know the animals there, I mean, we have a hard time. We don't know what this kind of sound is. If we had never heard a snake hissing, you know, we wouldn't know that it's a snake. But if the moment we see it and we see it hissing, you know, we associate it, and that is nothing else than the function of memory. It associates one sound with a snake, or with a rat, or with a chicken, or with a peacock, or a squirrel. I mean, you will get used to the squirrels here. I mean, they make quite loud sounds. Or turtles. I mean, they also make sounds. So, the working hand in hand of these five groups give us the illusion that there is a personality, that there is I. I mean, we can make the example, or we can, you know, we can make some test, sit down, and whatever comes, we put into one of these categories. We put into one of these groups. And then you will see there's no I involved. There's either a memory just came up, or a thought just came up, a thought, or a feeling came up, or a sense of the body came up. Ah, so where's the I? It's just like, you know, you open a watch, and you just see the wheels turning, and it doesn't make any sense, does it? You close the watch, and then you have the pointers, and it tells you the time. Oh, now it's 20 to 2. Ah, wonderful. You open the watch and there's no meaning to it anymore. Because you don't see, you see it working, but you don't have the pointer. You don't give any meaning to it. And that is the same with the five groups. I mean, if you put everything into the five groups, you know, the personality or I, the sense of I, would disappear. I mean, there's the body. And that is exactly what the Lord Buddha gave us as a teaching. He said, this is not me. What did he say? This is not me. He said, the body, this is not me, this is not mine, that does not belong to me. He also said, feeling, this is not me, that is not mine, that doesn't belong to me. He also said, memory, this is not me, that doesn't belong to me, this is not mine. And thought, the same for thought and consciousness. There is, I mean, just ask yourself, who is the one who knows that there is a thought coming? Does the thought know about itself? Does the thought know it's a thought? Does the feeling know it's a feeling? Does the memory know it's a memory? Does the body know it's a body? Does the liver know it's a liver? Does the shit know that shit? And that its mouth and stings? Who knows it? Huh? So we concentrated on the wrong person. If you would concentrate on the right person, of the one who knows, I mean, there wouldn't be any personality. There would be just memory, just body, just thought, just feeling. What do I have to do? What has the observer to do with the feeling? It's not him. It's just like you going and watch a movie. What do you have to do with the movie? But you still cry. You still get angry. Don't you? Why? Because you're attached to it. You feel for them. You laugh with them, you cry with them, you feel for them, you get angry with them, and so on. Everything. Because you associate with them. You identify with them. So that's the same thing. You identify with the five groups, and suddenly, you know, you are in dukkha. You have a lot of dukkha. Because you don't like this, or you don't like that, or this, or that, or that. The moment we do not associate it, and that's why the Lord Buddha gave us this heart. This is not me, this is not mine, that doesn't belong to me. Feeling is not me, feeling arises and ceases. A pleasant feeling will change into an unpleasant feeling, and an unpleasant feeling will change into a pleasant feeling. That's the way it is. Just like a movie, it is laid out, you know, before we even watch it, it was laid out, we can't change it. So, see yourself in your own life story. The movie about your life story. You can't change it. It was laid out the moment you were born. And now it's happening. And you constantly resist. You constantly resist. Why is this happening to me? I mean, why is it not happening to somebody else? I mean, de-associate with it, and then you will find, okay, only a feel. Okay, only a thought. Okay, only a memory. That's it. That's how things have happened. And then that stage, because our sati is so great, our awareness of the things that are happening is so great, there are no kilesas, or there are no fangs of avijja. So they are not muddled up. So within the investigation, we have to make sure, when we investigate these five khandhas, we have to make sure that the kilesas are not going to be muddled up. That we suddenly do not associate with these things that we see or that we experience. And then it becomes a very successful investigation, because we can separate it out. And then we see memory is just a memory. And avijja is just avijja. Or greed is just greed. I mean, does the body long for anything? No. We think it longs for food. No. The body doesn't long. The body really doesn't care if it gets food or not. I mean, it just knows how to work, you know, in its own environment. If there's no water, you know, it just tries to pull out as much water. If there's no water for 4 or 5 days, it just will die. It will crack open. Dry up. That's all what the body knows. It doesn't know if there's hunger. It doesn't know if there's no water. It doesn't know if there's cold or if there's heat. It just operates on its own principle. So, who is the one who knows that it's cold and warm and that it's hungry or thirsty? No. The knowingness, the chitta. Nobody else. So the chitta is fooled. And the chitta is fooled by avijja. That does not really understand. Like, just like it. And just, it's, that's only with the body. But we always think, you know. We think in this way because we were raised in this context. You think that the body wants sex. It's not the body that needs sex. It's a chitta. It's a chitta that feels lonely and wants the other sex. The body is nothing else than the car. I mean, whoever is its driver, if he is reckless, you know, he wrecks the car very, very early. If he's a very careful driver, you know, the car will go for a long, long time. And if he does repairs once in a while, you know, the car will last for a long time. And it's just the same with the body. The chitta is the driver of the body. I mean, if he does care for the body, you know, the body will last for quite a while, quite a long time. If he doesn't care for the body, you know, it won't last that long. That's all. I mean, you can say that the chitta is living in a biological robot. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's a program of this robot. Now, once we know that, I mean, then we have to liberate ourselves and remove all these programs of these robots that lead to unhappiness. Or dukkha, or dissatisfaction, or disease, or whatever you call it, or pain or suffering. I mean, our program is nothing else than conditioning. If this is happening, then this action has to follow. If I see food, you know, I have to eat it. I just can't pass by on it. That's a programming. So we remove it. First of all, we see that conditioning, and then we say, stop, no, I don't. And then we do that 10 times, or 100 times, or 1,000 times, until that condition is removed. And then we go to the next condition. If I see this person, I want to smack his face. First thing is, no. We say no. And then after a while, we start to smile at that person instead of getting angry. Until that condition is removed. And so on, and so on. And then we see, you know, just looking at ourselves, how many conditions we have to remove until we are unconditioned. And also, strangely enough, or not so strangely, Nibbana is also called the unconditioned, where no condition is. So removing one of the kilesas are just the fang of avijja, or you can call it the military of the master. I mean, just his soldiers, just his troops. They try to constantly tickle us and influence us with pain or fear or fright or this or that. Oh. First of all, we have to fight these soldiers. That's a battle. Because these soldiers are telling us, I want this. And then if you have a little bit of sati, if you have a little bit of awareness, you say, stop, no, I don't want it. And then, the longer we do that, the longer we act against our own programming, the more we see what is really behind. I mean, we don't see avijja in the first step. I mean, we'll see it and we will understand it. And the first thing that we will see, and that will only come after a long, long time of practice, we will see actually the fangs of avijja, the kilesas, or the soldiers. Constantly, you know, pulling us off from us. Just like, you know, just like a mother goes with his little child into a supermarket, and that little child sees this and this and wants this and wants that, and cries and cries and cries until it gets it. If the mother is good, you know, it says no. And then sooner or later the child will stop. And if their mother does it constantly, then it knows, you know, whatever it sees, it will never get it. So it won't cry because it knows it's senseless. So it's the same with the kilesas. If they see that we don't follow their commands anymore, in the beginning, of course, they will peace at us, you know, they will inflate pain or anger or hate or greed into us, and then if you don't follow it, I mean, sooner or later they have to stop. And then we can remove that conditioning forever from our heart. But of course, you know, it sounds very easy, but the tough part is the doing it, to go against the pain, to go against these unpleasant feelings that come up within our practice. I mean, first of all, we have to learn just to be with this movie of somebody, you know, facing a lot of pain. I mean, we still know that we sit in the back seat, you know, so okay, we watch this person on the movie, you know, having a lot of pain and do not associate it with it. Until we can see, okay, pain is coming and pain is going. Unpleasant feelings are coming and unpleasant feelings are going. And then you also see that they are not you, that they are not mine, that they don't belong to you. No, because somebody is actually observing this. And the moment, as long as you observe it, you're just aware of it, I mean, there is no dukkha. But the moment you have the feeling there's dukkha, then you know you identify with something. So you can remove this identification. I mean, you just put it, you know, put it in the distance. If something is too close to our eyes, we can't read it. Okay, put it away. Okay, read it. Okay, understand. But it's not me, you know, because I read that. It's something outside. So just face up with it, you know. In the beginning, of course, when we just do train our mind on samadhi, and samadhi means peacefulness, happiness, calm, concentration. I mean, we do not do investigation. We do not investigate these things. So what happens there is just the only thing that will bother us is pain. Pain in our knees, pain in our back, pain in our muscles. And they will get stronger and stronger the longer we sit. So when do we give up? Or, in other terms, when does the mother give in to the cries of the child and buys the things for it? So, that's when we give up. Whenever we buy into it, whenever we believe these voices, they tell us, okay, you sit so long, you know, you break your leg. Okay, up you go. Or you ruin your back. Or this pain is too much. You buy into it and you get up and stop the practice. And that's all what they intend us. That's all what the Kiliasas intend us, to stop us from practicing. Because now, in the end, it will be harmful to them. I mean, it's just like a tyrant, you know, he doesn't let his subjects go up easily. The moment the tyrant sees, you know, that his subjects going against his will, you know, he will go and force them. And the more they don't want, you know, the more he forces them. Until they can break loose. Okay. But he will not, you know, he will not watch it over until all the subjects disappear from his power. He will not. No way he won't. You see it in the world, you know. I mean, each kind of minister or each kind of president, even if it's charged with the outrageous charges, I mean, he will not remove his power unless he is removed. I mean, he will not give in easily say, okay, people, I did a great mistake, so I will retreat. No way. Until he's not forced with guns, you know, 10 guns pointing at his head, he will not go. Because he loves that power. Or the money, or whatever comes with it. And that's the same thing for a vicha. So don't think that you can persuade it. That's a good, go away, you know, go away. I don't want you anymore. I'm sick of you, you know, just leave me. Anyway. So you have to put a fight. You have to put up a fight. When you sit in samadhi, you have to put up a fight with unpleasant feelings. I mean, the only exception for samadhi, normally we just concentrate on the Buddha, or we concentrate on the breath, or the combination of Buddha and the breath. But if the pain in our knees or in our body becomes too strong, then we can do, actually. That is the only thing that is allowed in point of investigation. Then we can go to the point of pain and investigate what is pain. What the hell is pain? Is the pain, and where is the pain? First of all, locate the pain. And then go, instead of our concentration on the tip of the nose, go with our concentration to the tip or to the point of pain. And then investigate the pain. Just like you observe the breath, if the breath is shallow or short or long or coarse or deep or whatever, observe the pain. Is the pain, you know, shallow or coarse or strong? Is it moving? Is it changing? Is it this or is it that? Once you understand that, is it a point or is it an area? Once you understand that, you go more into detail. Where exactly is this pain located? Is it in the skin? Or is it in the bones? Or is it in the nerves? Or is it in the muscles? Or where is this pain? I'm sure you can't find it. I mean, but at the moment, at the beginning, of course, you assume that the pain is in the muscles, or the pain is in the nerves. And I mean, if the pain would be in the nerves, I mean, our nerves would be constantly in pain. In other terms, if the pain and the nerves are one and the same thing, I mean, we would be constantly in pain. If the pain and the skin is one and the same thing, our skin would be constantly in pain. But it isn't. It's just, you know, once in a while. Boop, it comes and boop, it disappears. That's it, that's all. Same with the muscles. It comes and disappears. It's not the muscles, the pain is different from the muscles. I mean, the body doesn't even know what pain is. The only one who knows is the citta that knows that it's pain. And the citta is that one that also doesn't like pain. That's why the citta gives up. The body does no pain, and it is not really in the body. It doesn't seem to be in the body. All what happens is, and that is what we have to understand with pain, all what is happening is a constant change that takes place in the body. And we know, if you dream something, you know, certain things are changing. If you eat something, you know, constantly, any time of the day, you know, there's a change in the body. But only some of it we call pain and some of it we call pleasant. I mean, that is our definition of it. So the investigation of pain is really leading us to the truth of pain. What is pain and where does it come from? But our memory, of course, tells us, you know, all the things that we studied or learned in the West. Of course, if you sit in this position, you know, for a long time, you know, and then we give in to the rationalizations of the kilesa, not really knowing what pain is, but we really want to see it, we really want to feel it, we really want to experience it for ourselves, not trusting anybody else. Not trusting the professionals. I mean, what the professionals know, they know just a little bit more than we do. But who knows the body better than we? Nobody. The citta knows the body as, you know, nobody else knows this body that we inhabit better than our citta. So all what we need to do is ask our citta. Don't need a doctor for that. I mean, we can see, if we want to, we can see, we can go with our attention or concentration in any part of the body and see it. I mean, see it in front of our own eyes. I mean, not physical eyes, but with our mental eyes. And sometimes the image is even sharper than with our physical eyes. We can see it. We can look at it. Ah, okay. We can see deformation, so we can see that it's probably good, you know? It's healthy. we then can take a knife, you know, and cut it up. If you're interested, you know, what is it, you know? I mean, liver, what does it mean? Do we know what it means? It's a piece of meat, you know? This kind of color and this kind of size. But, you know, okay, let's cut it up, you know, what it's made out of. What is its function, you know, understand it. We don't need books for that, we need just our chitta and attention onto it. So we understand the functioning. We see what is coming in and we see what is going out. And we see the processes take place in the liver or in the diet or whatever you call it. Or in the stomach, you know, just look at the food in the stomach of, you know, that is the easiest investigation we can do. I mean, eat something in the morning, you know, remember what it looked like, you know, and then 2 hours later you go in your stomach and look at the food. I mean, is it that the thing that you still want to eat again? But it's still food. Very valuable food. But you want to grab it out, take it and eat it again? So, I mean, you don't eat for the body. You eat only for the tongue, for the senses, you know, for the pleasant senses in the tongue. The moment it leaves the tongue, you know, it comes there, I mean, all the senses are gone. There, no senses. I mean, it doesn't care, you know, the stomach doesn't care what you eat. But you care what you eat. This is sweet, this is sour, this is, you know, this is bitter. This is, you know, this is like this, you know, oh, that is... But we don't even go to this. This is salt. We go, this is raw. This is delicious. This is nice. You know, I want more of it. I want more of it. I want more of it. And in the end, you know, our stomach can't take it. You know, it's too full. All the energy of the whole body dumps into the stomach. Huh? And we can't practice anymore. We get tired. We want to sleep. And the moment we wake up from sleep, you know, we want to eat again, to sleep again. Isn't it? Oh. I mean, that's also a life. I mean, pigs have that kind of life. Or normal animals, you know. If they're hungry, most of them have to hunt, you know, as long as they're not in human possession. They have to hunt for their food. Okay, they have to do some work. But the moment they're full, you know, they go and sleep. And then they wake up, you know, they're hungry again, they hunt and they eat. So, I mean, compared to that, you know, we are not much different. So don't look down on animals. And especially don't kill them. I mean, they have just the same right to live as we do. So, with this I end the talk, give this for your reflection and your training, and it's all up to you. I mean, I can only help you by pointing out the way. I mean, you have to help yourself to follow the practice. And if you practice correctly with what the Lord Buddha teaches or what I think I say it in the same language, I mean, you have to experience the result, just like I described it. Because actually the results that I describe are the results I, my personally, experienced. And I just followed the same, what I told you. So you have to experience. But of course, you know, you have to put in a little bit of stance, you know, you have to put up a stance or you have to put in a fight. To go beyond this little naughty child that constantly wants this and wants that, and cries if he doesn't get it. So, are there any questions? Now, because there's a lot of things to do, let's get our energy to do.
Can you see all the things we
have? Yeah.
To do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How long do you want to stay? 3 weeks?
Just over 2 weeks. Yeah.
Hmm?
So 2 weeks.
Today is Wednesday, huh? So, I mean, just for this time, no, we skip Friday and we meet on Sunday. I want some rest as well. And you have a lot of things to do. And when I meet you on Sunday, I mean, you know, you are happy, your faces should be shining, because you actually practice apana samadhi.
So, this few days we have to finish our meals within 10 minutes.
Good. Just like the monks. I mean, they get their meal, you know, and if they eat more than 10 minutes, you know, the meal is gone. I mean, just be careful that you don't eat, you know, what your tongue wants, but what your stomach can take, what is healthy for the body. Don't eat according to your likes, you know, what your tongue likes, yeah? Or at least, you know, investigate the processes that take place on in the stomach after you've eaten something. I mean, if you're a little bit aware, if you have a little bit of subtlety, I mean, you know exactly what is good, wholesome for the body or not. What gives you energy, what makes you tired, what makes you, you know, upset stomach or things like that. I mean, just investigate. I mean, you all have the power to do it. You know what you ate and you know the effects of it. You know, just 2 hours later, you are half an hour, sometimes half an hour late. I mean, you just knew that you overeat because you're so tired. You can't lift up your body. I mean, that tells you next time you eat less, no? And then next time you eat, you still eat too much. And then you say, you know, you have just to be very, very patient with yourself. I mean, just things don't change, you know, from one day to the other. I mean, today I see I overeat, and today I make the decision, tomorrow I don't overeat. Tomorrow I see myself eating a little bit less, but it's still too much. So you make the decision, you know, to eat still less. And then still less, until it is, you know, perfect. Sometimes you even can go to the extreme and say, I mean, some people like it, you know, they eat too much and then they eat too little. So what is the feeling of overeating and what is the feeling of underfeeding? Ah, interesting.
Hunger.
That's not a pleasant feeling. But is overeating a pleasant feeling? No, it's not a pleasant feeling either. So, swap out, you know, see, you know, experience for yourself what is good for you. And see for yourself what kind of food is healthy for your practice. I mean, the food that you take in here is different from the food that you take in the world if you have to work 8 hours a day. And if you have to work just with your mind, okay, that's another kind of food you need. If you have to work bodily, I mean, you will need other food. I mean, you know for yourself what you need. But just take the opportunity of this monastery that has so little things going on to take care about yourself, to see what you're doing and to see what kind of effects it will have on your doing, on your stomach or on your actions or your mind or on your chitta. Just look at the effects it has. That's all. I mean, you have so ample time, you can do that. That is finding out cause and effect. And cause and effect is nothing else than the law of karma. If we eat too much, you know, we are unhappy because we are overeating. It's an unpleasant feeling to overeat. We feel so tired, you know, and when we are tired, you know, we are not really happy. We just want to sleep, you know. When we sleep, you know, we have so bad dreams, you know. We wake up, you know, and we're so restless because of our bad dreams. I mean, all this, you know, led to a whole series of events. Just, you know, just not stopping, you know, because the food was so delicious. Leads to a whole series of bad events. Or unwholesome events, if you want to say. And just eating, you know, and taking the opposite. Eating too little. will lead only to one event. You know, there's a hungry feeling, but we don't feel sleepy, so we don't have bad dreams and things like that. There's just a little bit of discomfort of feeling hungry. So. Well, what can I say? Happy working.